Hello, everybody. This is Dadaveda Pragyananda, and you were just listening to the opening sounds of this program, which are the Kirtan mantra, Bhavanam Kevalam. And the meaning of that mantra is only the name of the Most Beloved. And it was sung by the singers at the Anandalina Spiritual Community in Illinois, which is where I'm sitting right now recording this message. Today, I want to speak about a subject which is known as Ashtanga Yoga. It means eight limbs of yoga. Today, I know that some people have kind of branded the name, you know, for a certain style of yoga. But actually here, I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to a system of yoga which was put into place 200 years before the time of Christ by a man named Patanjali, a yogic sage. And what he did was he took the practices of yoga, which had been practiced for thousands of years even before him, but he put it into a form which is easily understood and which has become the base of most modern understanding of yoga today. And it's really important to go into the whole subject of Ashtanga Yoga, because there are eight parts of yoga, because commonly when we use the word yoga, people are only thinking about one branch, which is the yoga postures or asana. But as we're going to see, that the yoga asana is really just part of a system. It's an important part, no doubt. But if you take it out of the system, you're losing a lot if you only practice the physical part of yoga. And also, another thing, before we begin, it's good to know what is the total goal of yoga. So the goal of yoga is understood by the meaning of the term. Yoga means unification. So the unification of the small consciousness with the supreme consciousness is what is known as yoga. So how to do that? Then you need a system. And Patanjali laid out a system of practice, which is very important. So what is this? What are these eight limbs? We'll start at the beginning. The first limb is known as jama, or yama commonly, Y-A-M-A. But, you know, in Sanskrit, when the Y comes at the beginning of the word, it should be pronounced as a J, so jama. In fact, even what we call yoga is really should be yoga. But anyway, we'll use the common parlance, yoga. So this jama or yama are practices, means controlled conduct which will put you into harmony with your surroundings, with the people around you. This is called jama. So what are these practices? There are five of them. The first one in Sanskrit is ahimsa, and it means non-injury. It means not to inflict harm or pain on others without any, you know, reason, just for the sake of inflicting harm. So, yeah, it means to be good, to not to hurt people in thought, word, and deed. So this is ahimsa. It doesn't mean strictly complete non-violence or non-use of force, because we have to take an interpretation of it which we can live with. For example, in India, there are some people who follow the Jain religion, and they have an interpretation of ahimsa which is very extreme. In fact, they won't go outside without, they'll put on a mask so they don't kill microbes, and they won't till the soil because they might kill an earthworm. But if we take that interpretation, it becomes very difficult to live in this world. And in fact, they can't even follow that because they won't till the soil, but they will hire somebody to till it for them. So it's not really a practical way. So we need a practical ahimsa that we can live with. So that means that certainly within our possibility, we're never going to hurt people or hurt living things needlessly. But we do have to you're a vegetarian, you take an apple, you know, you're taking life. But so here, the way to do it is to not to take any life. And if you have to take it, then take it where the consciousness is least developed. So that's why, like for instance, I'm a vegetarian, because one of the reasons is because animals have a higher consciousness, but I have to take some life to live, so I'll take it from the plant life, which is consciousness is less developed. And also in this interpretation of ahimsa, which is based on a book called Guide to Human Conduct by my master Sri Sri Anandamurti, he also advised that you can defend yourself if someone attacks you. So this is like a reasonable interpretation of ahimsa that we can live with. But the general principle we should always hold it dear in our heart is not to inflict harm on others, and not to break the physical, mental, or spiritual progress of others knowingly. So this is the first step of living in harmony with those around you. Then the second one is called satya. Satya has no English equivalent. There's no exact equivalent of this word, satya. Sometimes it's loosely translated as true, truthfulness, to be true. The real meaning of it, the meaning which is very important to know, is that it's based on welfare, the idea of to bring about the welfare of others, to think for the welfare of others. So thinking and speaking in the spirit of welfare is satya. So what this means is we should be straightforward, and in general it means telling the truth, and we tell things which are going to help people. But it doesn't mean exact truthfulness, because in some cases, if you tell the truth immediately to someone, it may be harmful to them or harmful to their interest. There are two examples I can give. One example is that if you're with somebody and they're taking their meal, and then they ask you, you know, maybe about one relative who has just passed away, maybe they say, how is Aunt Jane? And it might not be a good idea to tell that Aunt Jane has passed away. You say, oh, she's all right now, I think, you know, we can find out later, we can call her. Or another case of where you might not tell the truth exactly, but is an example where somebody, some kind of a ruffian has come to your door and is asking for the whereabouts of some person, and you see that this ruffian has some evil intention. So you say, oh, I don't know where my friend is. He's not here now. He may right be in the next room, but for the welfare of your friend, you may say he's somewhere else. But the idea was that here you were not trying to deceive for the sake of deception, but you were speaking in the spirit of welfare. So thinking and speaking in the spirit of welfare is a very important point. And in fact, this point has a big ramification on the mind. If you work in this way, in a very straightforward manner, you develop a mental and a spiritual strength. The straightforwardness brings about strength of will, strength of character, and it will help you. The strength that you get from working for the welfare of others, thinking for the welfare of others, doing for the welfare of others, it builds a strength of character which will help you in your entire life, and especially in your yoga practice. So the satya, thinking and speaking and doing in the spirit of welfare, is a huge point in yoga. So remember that, satya, the second point of the jhamma, sadhana. Then the third part of the jhamma or yama sadhana is called asteya. And asteya means not to steal, not to take possession of those things which are not yours. So this is simple. You know that you shouldn't take. But there's also another aspect of it. Sometimes we look at some glittering object and we think, oh, I would take it, but the guard is standing there, I'll get in trouble. So, but mentally you have already taken something. So even the practice of the asteya means also to give up the mental concept of taking. So this is and there's more. In fact, if I go into the jhamma niyama, the second point, I can spend the whole podcast. So I won't do that now. I'm going to, at another time, we'll do a whole podcast on the jhamma and niyama. So the third one was asteya, and the fourth one is brahmacharya. Brahmacharya means to remain attached to Brahma or the supreme entity. And the idea here is to treat every object and every person of this world as an expression of the supreme consciousness. So this is brahmacharya sadhana. In ancient times, it was confused with complete celibacy, but this was just something that was practiced by monks and nuns, and then it couldn't be applied for the common people. So this is really not a proper interpretation of it, although if you look in some books on yoga, you'll see that's what it means. But it's not celibacy. It means to keep your mind engaged with the cosmic idea, even in your physical actions in this world. So this is brahmacharya. And then another practice, the fifth one, is called aparigraha. Aparigraha means not to take those things which are superfluous for your existence. So what it means is like simple living. Basically, it's simple living, to live in a simple way with what you need and don't acquire luxuries that are not necessary. Now, what is what you need and what you don't need, and what is a necessity, what is a luxury, that really changes according to the time, the place, and the person. For example, 100 years ago, to own a car was a great luxury. There were very few of them, and they were expensive, relatively expensive, and only a few people could have it. That was a luxury. But today, to own a car is a necessity. So just this change in the time has changed it. For instance, for a teenage boy, to own a car would be a luxury, but for his father to own it is a necessity. So the change in the person has also changed what is a luxury and what is a necessity. So remember this, but the general idea is take little, take just what you need. And if you practice these first five principles of the jhamma sadhana, or jhamma meditation, or jhamma spiritual practice, you will be in harmony with your surroundings around you. You're not hurting anybody. You're speaking and doing and thinking for welfare. You're not stealing. You're treating others with respect, that they are an expression of the supreme consciousness. You're not taking too much from the planet. You're taking what you need. If you can follow these five parts of jhamma, which is actually only the first part of Ashtanga Yoga, you will start to enter into harmony with others. Then, the second part of the of Ashtanga Yoga, the second limb of yoga, is called Niyama. Niyama. Here the Y is in the middle, so it's pronounced as a Y. Niyama. So Niyama are also practices of restraint, of conduct, but these practices are not geared so much at the society, but they're helpful to you in your self-purification. So what is this niyama, sadhana? The first one in Sanskrit is known as shaucha, and that means cleanliness and purity. So we should have cleanliness of our body and our environment, and purity of the mind, to keep good thoughts in the mind. So this is, you know, you've heard the expression, cleanliness is next to godliness. So really, if you want to practice, you know, the higher practices of yoga and meditation, this is a base. This is your personal cleanliness, your surroundings, your environmental cleanliness. And interestingly here is that we understand how to clean your clothes and clean the body and clean the environment. You get your vacuum cleaner out or you get your soap and water out, you know. But what about the mind? How will we purify the mind? So there's one very nice way how to purify the mind, and that is that when you get a thought which you understand it's not a good thought, like the birthday cake comes out and about 10 people around it and you are there and you feel, wow, I could eat this whole thing. And it's not a very, it's a greedy thought, isn't it? I'll eat the whole thing, who cares for the others? So if you, when we get these kind of thoughts, if they come, so what happens when you get a thought like that? You know it's not the best thought in the world. So when you get a thought like this, what you have to do is cultivate the opposite thought and then carry it out. So then when that thought comes, I'll eat the whole cake, then you think, no, I should share it with others. And then you should take the lead. You cut the cake, you serve the others and serve yourself last. And when you do that, that thought, which is not a very noble thought, will fade into the background. So this is how you handle that. And so if you keep doing that, then you're purifying the mind. So we have to pay attention to purify the body and the mind. So this is the first part of the niyama, or the second limb of Ashtanga Yoga. Then the third one is called santosha. Santosha means contentment, contentment of mind. It means to keep the mind in a state of ease. You know, like when you have an uneasy, you know, you're really hungry, wow, you have to eat something, then you eat something, and you go, ah. So that state of ease is tosha. So santosha means to keep your mind in a state of ease all the time, as much as possible. Generally, the idea here is to work and then accept the rewards of the work and then to relax and then to rest. So this is santosha. So a very important principle. In fact, you know, it's related to that aparigraha I mentioned before, not taking too much. So those people who take too much from the world, they're never able to find contentment. And actually, contentment is what we want. And this, you know, if you want a big bank account or something, it's only so that you'll get some ease. You feel, okay, I'm comfortable. But people who take too much from the world, they will never find. They're never able to practice santosha. Anyway, it's a very important point, and try to practice that as best you can. And then another part of the niyama, the third part, is called tapa. And it means to practice penance to reach the goal. Penance doesn't mean to flagellate yourself, you know, like the Middle Ages, the people, some religious people used to do, to beat themselves so that they can take away their sins. No, but it just means to take some of the burden of the suffering of others on yourself. And it means to do service to others, selfless service. And if you do selfless service to others, you might say, well, what does this have to do with yoga? It's a big thing, because if you go into the higher practices of yoga, one of the biggest obstacles is basically your ego. You're thinking about yourself. You're meditating, but you're just thinking about, I want to do this, I want to do that, I have to do this, and someone said this to me. You're thinking about your ego. So we have to stop thinking about the ego. And one of the best ways to stop thinking about the ego is to do some service to others. And when you do service to others and you're thinking about them, you start to forget about yourself. So it's a wonderful part of the yogic practice, this selfless service known as tapa. After tapa comes swadhyaya. Swadhyaya means, literally it means good reading. It means to read the works of enlightened people, spiritual people, and not only to read it, but to understand the underlying meaning. Because many people try to read things mechanically, and then they claim merit. Oh, I read the Bible so many times, I read this scripture so many times, but they haven't really assimilated the underlying message of it. So the idea here is that you should read with real meaning, and that kind of reading will inspire you it will help you to move on the spiritual path, because we need inspiration from time to time. That's why good company is also one part of it. But sometimes when you can't get that physical good company of somebody, you can read the works of an enlightened person or a great person, and it's almost like you're hanging out with that person, so it will help you very much. So, swadhyaya. And that brings us to the last part of the niyama sadhana, and that's called Ishvara Pranidhan, Ishvara Pranidhana. So Ishvara means the controller of the universe. Pranidhana means to take refuge, to take shelter. It means basically to accept that your goal of your practice is to become one with that Supreme Consciousness and to make that the real goal of your life. You know, we have intermediate goals for sure. We say, I want to graduate from school, I want to get a job, and so many things. These are certainly things we have to do, but we should never lose sight of our final goal, our ultimate goal, which is to become one with that Supreme Consciousness. And the way to practice this particular part of the niyama is through the daily meditation, because in daily meditation, then what are you doing? You're thinking of your goal. You're trying to become one with your goal. So this is Ishvara Pranidhana. So in niyama, just to summarize, and there are five principles which help you to purify yourself and to move towards your spiritual goal. And they are cleanliness, shaucha, and purity of mind also in that point, and contentment of mind, santosha, and service to others, which is tapa, and swadhyaya, which is the reading and understanding of spiritual works. And the last point is to meditate on the goal, on that Supreme Consciousness, which is the goal of yoga. So yama or jama and niyama, these are the first two limbs of Ashtanga yoga, and they're really the base. Everything depends on them. So that's why I've spent a little bit of time on it, because it's really important. It should never be neglected. And now we come to the third limb of yoga, and this is the limb of yoga which is most well known. It's called asana. Asana means a posture which is easily held. Now, sometimes if you look at a yoga book or if you've seen somebody curl up like a pretzel with both ankles behind his head, you know, all intricate, then you say, wow, that's easy. Now, the idea here is that in these postures, when you reach the posture, you don't need much effort to remain in the posture, which is different from, there are some other yoga practices called mudra or bandhas, where you have to move your muscles in a certain way and then exert, hold pressure to keep it there. But asana means a posture which is easily held. So what are these yoga postures? What are they? They're not like normal, like jumping jacks and sit-ups and other kind of exercises, because they have some other purposes. And one of the main purposes of the asanas is the regulation of the internal glands of the body, the endocrine glands. And so no other exercises have ever been constructed which have been focused so much on the glands as the yoga asanas. And also, these yoga asanas are named after animals, and this legend has it that they were even invented by yogis who were watching animals do different kind of movements, which help them in their regulate their health. These asanas are postures which will, if practiced properly, will, and with the proper combination of yoga postures, it's possible to prevent many diseases and even cure diseases if coupled with good diet and other rules of health. So yoga postures are a tremendous help for people, but they should be selected properly, because not everybody has the same body, same mind, and so there are different yoga postures that are needed according to the the kind of body that a person has, and according to the strength and weakness of the chakras. The chakras are a term which is often talked about in yoga, but they're simply the psycho-spiritual centers along the spine which regulate the different propensities of mind, and they also are connected with the different physical organs. So if there's weakness in different parts of the body, different chakras, then a proper yoga instructor can pick the asanas which are needed for a particular person. That person will practice them, and those asanas will help that person to acquire good health and maintain good health. And so this is really the role of the yoga asanas. It's to prepare the body, to prepare the body for health. And also it does have a mental function, because these yoga chakras, these centers of psycho-spiritual nerve centers or energy centers, also affect the mind. So if you can balance the body, then the mind will also be balanced. So the yoga postures are a very integral part of the total practice. But they're not the end. We didn't come here just to have a nice body or lose some weight or even to get even balance of the mind. We want to do something with the mind, and that is to bring it to its highest realization. And that's when we start to take help of some of the other practices of Ashtanga Yoga. And the fourth practice is called Pranayama. Pranayama means, prana means the vital energy, and yama means the control, as we learned before in Jama Sadhana. So pranayama means the control of the vital energies. Now, the vital energies are connected with the breath, but yoga has also identified actually 10 winds or vital airs in the body. And these winds, they're in 5 internal, 5 external, and they control the beating of the heart, the moving of the blood, hunger and thirst, and hiccuping and spasmodic motions and jumping and all of our motion. So these vital energies have to be controlled. And they have a controlling point, which is in the center of the chest, which the yogis know as the pranendriya. And the pranendriya, sometimes considered in yoga as the 11th organ, although it's not really an organ, and it's not an anatomical entity either. But it's a controlling point, and what its function is to unite the mind with the sensory perceptions. And sometimes that doesn't happen. For instance, suppose you're running a race, you're a 100-yard dash, and then after that race, what will happen? You'll be breathing very heavily. And if at that time you try to, you know, eat something, someone gives you a cupcake, and you're still breathing, then you won't even know the taste. You won't know if it's a vanilla or a banana cupcake or a raspberry cupcake, unless you see the color, maybe you might see it. But from the taste, you're not going to know anything. And the reason why is that when the breath is pulsating rapidly, the pranendriya is also pulsating, and the mind doesn't connect with the sensory organs. And so there is no perception. So what the yogis do, they do some breathing exercises, and when they do that exercise, the pranendriya, the breath, comes to a halt practically. And when the breath comes to a halt, the pranendriya is still. And at that point, the mind becomes still. And in that stillness, then meditation is heightened. So the pranayama is a practice for stilling the mind. So it's a very it's a wonderful practice if it's practiced properly. But here I have to give a note of caution, is that it has to be done under the right circumstances, And there has to be a cosmic idea associated with the stillness of the mind. Because if you're doing pranayama and then you're thinking angry thoughts or mean thoughts, or then those thoughts will be heightened and it's not good. So it should be done properly, and there's a whole science of it. And also, it's best done under the instruction of a teacher. And just to rush into it is also not advisable. But pranayama, when done properly, then it's one of the greatest means of quieting the mind and of preparing the base for higher meditation. So this is what I would say right now about pranayama. And then we move on. Another practice in Ashtanga Yoga is called pratyahara. Pratyahara means to withdraw from the sensory organs, to withdraw our attention from the outside and bring it to the inside. So you know that when you try some meditation or some contemplation, one of the biggest problems is that although you're trying to bring your mind within, you're still engaged in all the things that you were doing before, and your senses are working, and you're hearing the traffic in the street, and then your leg is aching, and your back is hurting, and you have a difficulty. So many things are going on. So we need some practices which will help us to withdraw from the noise out on the street. We need to withdraw from the body itself. We need to take the mind to a proper point for meditation. So pratyahara is this practice, and it's included in certain techniques of meditation. And there's also another kind of pratyahara which in our Ananda Marga practice, which the practice I'm doing, it's one of the strongest practices that we have. It's called the offering of colors, van argya dan. It means to offer the colors of the mind. See, the thing is that when we're meditating, we're engaged in thoughts. Even the best meditator will have the thoughts of so many things. They're usually physical objects or psychic objects. So every thought has a vibration. Every vibration has a color. So if we could just take those colors and offer them back to where they came, where did they come from? They came from that supreme consciousness. Everything has come. All the physical things, all the thought waves, every vibration has come from that supreme entity. But now they're cluttering up our mind. We wish we could do something with them. So what can you do with them? You offer them back to that supreme entity. So one of our practices is the offering of colors, where the meditator imagines a lotus flower and offers that to the supreme consciousness. So this is also pratyahara yoga. Because when you offer that color, then you discard it. You're not attached to it anymore. So this is pratyahara yoga. And it's a very important part of the yogic practice. There are physical things that you can do also which will help your pratyahara. When you do your meditation, if you take a bath first and you're cool and clean, and these are physical aids of pratyahara. And then when you do your meditation, when there are certain psychic ways to withdraw the mind, and finally the most powerful way is to, after your meditation, to offer those thoughts back to where they came from. So this is pratyahara. And then, we're in more in the mental realm than in the physical realm. The next practice in Ashtanga Yoga is called dharana. Dharana means concentration. We have to concentrate the mind in a point. To bring the mind to a point is dharana. So there are, in the body, there are different chakras. Sometimes you have to maintain your concentration in a particular chakra. There are different exercises in meditation, different practices for this. So But it's essential, if you want to go into higher practices of meditation, that you have to be able to make the mind still in a particular point, fix the mind in a point. And this is called dharana. How to become proficient in dharana? How, 'cause that's the biggest problem that people come to when they learn meditation. They come and say, I can't concentrate, I can't keep my mind still. Well, no one is born with perfect concentration. It's a practice, it's an art, it's something that you have to work at. So when you meditate, you keep your mind in one place. If the mind moves, your mind moves, bring it back. Then it moves again, bring it back. And this action of bringing it back is like a conditioning. It's just like when you're running, you're doing some conditioning of your legs and your cardiovascular system, and when you're lifting weights, you're building a muscle. So here what you're doing is you're building a mental muscle, the strength of your mind to remain in one particular thought or one particular place. So the only way to become proficient in dharana is really to the practice according to the instruction which your teacher gave to you. So this is dharana. And then when a student becomes proficient in dharana, then it's possible to practice the deepest kind of meditation, which in Sanskrit is dhyana. Dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N. And dhyana means meditation. It means when the mind flows, like in an unbroken flow towards the cosmic entity. The mind is going with an unbroken rhythm towards the cosmic entity. This is dhyana. And this is the ultimate form of meditation. And it takes a proficiency first in dharana, to be a first to bring the mind to a place and then make it flow. And this dhyana is done sometimes with mantra and with other visual methods as well. So this is dhyana. And dhyana, the word is interesting because when it went to China, this practice, which was in India, actually in ancient times there was an interchange between India and China. Sometimes Indian tantric teachers went to China, and then also some Chinese teachers also came to India. And there was a very nice interchange in that time. And when the dhyana went to China, it was called Chan. I'm not a Chinese scholar, but it was spelled C-H-A-N. Maybe it's pronounced John. I'm not particularly sure on that. But in any case, that was dhyana was practiced there in China. And then when it went exported to Japan, then that same word, dhyana, chan, became Zen. So Zen meditation, Zen Buddhism is a meditation-based Buddhism based on the dhyana, which originated in the yoga practice of India. So this is the seventh step. It's the seventh practice, and it needs to be perfected. And when that's perfected, then we reach the eighth limb of yoga. And the eighth limb is more a result than a practice. The eighth limb is called samadhi. And what is samadhi? It means the trance of absorption. It means the absorption of the mind in the cosmic entity. When the mind is absorbed. And there are different kinds of absorptions, different kinds of samadhis. And the two major kinds are, one is called savikalpa samadhi, where the yogi's mind has become one with the cosmic mind, and he feels, I am the cosmic entity. I am the cosmic entity. He feels one with everything. But then there is even another samadhi, which is step above that, and there's no more feeling of I anymore. It's called nirvikalpa samadhi. And when a person reaches that, they don't even know that they're in that state because there's no more I to experience it. It's only when after they come out of that state, then they realize that they were in a state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi. So these are the eight limbs of yoga. It starts, and I spend most time on it, I believe, on the Jama and Niyama, which is the ethical base of yoga to live properly in the world. Five principles of Jama, which bring you into harmony with the society. Five principles of Niyama, which purify you, and this becomes the base of your practice. And then you can practice the yoga asanas, and the yoga asanas regulate the glands, they bring about the health of the body, and they help also to balance the mind by regulating the different glands in the different chakras. So they just give you a balanced mind. And then with that strong body, balanced mind, proper living in the world, then you go deeper into the mental or spiritual side of Ashtanga Yoga, and you start to practice the different techniques, such as pranayama. You learn how to control the breathing, and then to bring the mind to the stillest place you can imagine. And then from that still place, you'll also be withdrawn from the noises and sounds of the world, and the senses will be quiet. And in that state, then you concentrate on your point of concentration, your place where the mind is fixed. And then with your higher meditation, you just move it in an unbroken flow towards the Supreme Consciousness. And sooner or later, you'll be absorbed. When will that happen? When you want that thing very much, when that's all that you want, that you don't want any other thing, then that day will come when you will feel tremendous bliss. There is a story that once one boy was impatient to learn and to experience, to get this experience. He said, "I want it now." And so the guru said, "Oh, okay, maybe let me show you something." So he took him down to the lake and put his head under the water and then held it there. And then the boy was struggling, and he pushed up his head above the water and breathed. Ah. And so the guru said, "When you want that spiritual achievement as much as you wanted that breath, definitely you will get it." So the Ashtanga Yoga is just a way of practicing so that we will reach that goal. When we want only that, we're focused on that, and when we want that, we will get that. So this is Ashtanga Yoga, and I hope that you will study it, but more than study it, practice it. Namaskar. Oh,